Welcome back to the IBS Freedom Podcast. I am joined by my totally mediocre co-host, JK LOL. It's Amy Hollenkamp in the house with me. Hey,
everybody.
Today, we're going to talk about a doozy. And honestly, this could probably be a two-episode, but we're going to try to kind of cram it all in, and then we might have to do another one. We're going to talk about the stomach. GERD, acid reflux, gastritis, OMG. Let's get on with this conversation. So, Amy, I mean, really obvious answer. It's just everybody who has GERD and reflux has way too much stomach acid. Done deal.
I know.
PPI, you're cured, right? Like,
get some Nexium up in this business. That's what I'm saying.
Short episode. We're done. Okay, so guys, please review us 5 stars on your podcasting. No, I'm kidding. Bless their hearts, right? The conventional medical world who seems to think that way. There's more to it than that. There's a layer, I think, of dysbiosis. Predominantly, we're going to be talking about H. pylori and candida and how those two things can wreak havoc on your stomach. You know, there's the layer of dysbiosis. There's the layer of inflammation, particularly with gastritis, just like an inflamed, red-hot tummy. There is a stomach acid component to it, but I don't think it's as simple or clear cut as like everybody just has too much stomach acid, end of story.
Right.
And there's probably some things that I'm forgetting. The mucus lining is a pretty big deal. But Amy, where would you like to start off today's journey?
Yeah, I think I'd like to start it in the context of IBS, as our podcast is named. I think a lot of times, like from an IBS standpoint, a lot of the focus is on like lower intestinal type issues. And sometimes what people are feeling is the upper issues, but they kind of it gets labeled as IBS or SIBO. And there might be those components involved. You might have loose bowel movements, diarrhea, even constipation if you're having stomach issues. But I think a lot of the times, too, after treating SIBO or trying to do things for IBS, there's still that those stomach symptoms there. And sometimes if you're so focused on SIBO and not on potentially addressing some of those lingering stomach issues up top, it can lead to continuous problems down below also.
Yeah.
So I think from a stomach standpoint, it's such a crucial part of the equation because it sets up digestion.
Exactly.
So if there's factors that are off up top, it's just going to throw everything off balance downstream. It's kind of a domino effect if you're not digesting well up top, and it can create more IBS, more SIBO issues down below. So I think it's a really crucial piece, and sometimes we get very narrowly focused on like the intestines or or you know, the microbes in the small intestines or even the large intestines, that like things like stomach issues can be missed. And sometimes they're not, sometimes the symptoms can be more extreme, so it's harder to miss them, but sometimes they can be a little bit more elusive. But I definitely think it's a really, really key piece. And if the stomach is not in a healthy position, it's going to be really hard to have microbial balance, good digestion downstream, to eliminate symptoms, motility, exactly. Like everything really gets kicked off in the stomach.
Yeah. And I would agree. I think I've heard it worded a couple of ways. Like when I was doing my nutritional therapy coursework, that group tends to say that digestion is a north to south process, meaning you know, it starts with the mouth, or arguably the mind and that piece of it, the mindful eating, but it starts up top, and then you know, you care about the puzzle pieces in that order. So like work on digestion as it relates to like your mind and your chewing and that first, then esophagus and stomach, then small intestine, then colon. And like it's not this simple, but I'm going to propose that sometimes it is. There are a lot of people for whom it's almost useless to work on the colon environment because they don't have that domino set up first from stomach, where it's like you almost are wasting your time focusing on the intestines or the colon, where you should be focusing your effort first on the stomach, because then you're going to get better motility, you're going to get
Right.
better microbial control, you're going to be killing off the microbes that come down in your food and your drink, you're going to be regulating inflammation better, you're like motility is going to work better. Just everything is really truly set up by the degree to which your stomach can physically break down and mush up the food. And the digestive juices, namely stomach acid, but also things like pepsin that you have in the stomach and able to do that for you. And then how that affects the pH further down the tube. And I've definitely
Right.
seen that happen where like people are focusing all their effort, especially with SIBO, where they're like, oh, I just need to kill. I need to do the candybactins. I need to
Right.
do berberine. I need to do oregano. I need to do whatever. And then we take a step back and say, you know, maybe you don't. Just here, play with stomach acid. You know, supplementation, try to chew your damn food and see what happens. And it can be damn near miraculous, honestly.
Yeah. And I will say too, sometimes the herbs can be irritating to the if you have gastritis. I've definitely seen that, where like, you know, people are pushing a lot of herbs because maybe SIBO is there and maybe it needs that aggressive treatment, maybe not, but like it could be a timing issue as well, like what you're saying. You almost have to wrap up what's going on up top to even know how things are going to function down below. But once you get the stomach in a better place, but you're totally right. I think there's often this aggressive approach when SIBO's found, that like we just need to for sure just focus on that. And I think when it comes to acid reflux and GERD too, like SIBO is definitely a huge component for that. So sometimes people are thinking, you know, maybe the SIBO is like causing things to be pushed up. And that can be related to acid reflux. So a lot of times I do think it's not necessarily that like practitioners just are totally oblivious, but they think that they're gonna help by lowering the SIBO. But I've definitely seen a lot of cases where like focusing on the stomach is more impactful on reducing symptoms than working on clearing the SIBO.
I've seen it go both ways. I have seen
Right.
situations where people think they have, I don't know if I've seen it as much with overt acid reflux and like an acidy perception, but definitely people who think that they have indigestion.
Yep.
And then it turns out, oh, when they take antimicrobials for the SIBO, that symptom happens to go away. I don't think I've seen it quite as commonly with really overt cases of gastritis and that burning sensation. But it could happen. That again, like the SIBO, the gas is physically pushing up. It's similar, honestly, to how many pregnant women complain that they have
Yeah.
reflux during pregnancy because the
Yeah.
baby is physically taking up space and pushing up on the stomach and irritating the stomach. So,
Yeah.
SIBO, if it's bad enough and the bloat is bad enough, it could have that similar manifestation. But I've seen it go both ways where like treating the SIBO has been really impactful for the GERD.
Right.
And I've seen many more cases where treating the upper GI stuff, like the GERD and the reflux and the acid indigestion or gastritis, that sets the stage for better small bowel health or large bowel health.
Right. I'm in full agreement with you. I do see this trend that's like, oh, SIBO is the cause of, you know, acid reflux. I've definitely seen that like as a big thing just out there. And again, I think it's unfortunate because you can just miss a lot of the intricacies of what's going on in the stomach and how that's leading to what's happening downstream.
Well, and I think that's part of like the SIBO culture that honestly,
Right.
like ever since SIBO came into the spotlight, it's kind of purported to be the answer.
Right.
So then a lot of the conversation in podcasts and YouTube and blogs and whatever. A lot of the conversation, and certainly Facebook forums and like groups of people who have SIBO, a lot of the conversation is focused around I have X, but I have SIBO. So, like, SIBO was actually, you know, I have Hashimoto's, but it was really the SIBO all along. Or I have
Right,
X, but it
right.
was really the SIBO. And it's like sometimes that does end up being true.
But
Right. sometimes there's other stuff. Like, you can't forget the other stuff going on in your life. Maybe you had colon dysbiosis, or maybe you had toxic exposure, or stress, or shitty sleep, or like, there's other things that cause these problems other than just SIBO. But I do think SIBO gets hyper-focused on a lot of the time.
Right. I think it's like it's very horse blindery. I know that's not a great word, but that's the word that comes into my mind. Your horse blinders are on the SIBO, and then sometimes you neglect other key areas. I will say with things like stomach stuff too, because most people have been through the conventional route, or at least the ones that I've worked with have somewhat gone through the conventional route, and the conventional route seems like hyper-focused on stomach stuff too, and I feel like the functional route definitely has like some focus on things like stomach acid, and maybe like some support from a mucus lining standpoint. But I typically don't see that there's as much focus on the stomach in the functional space in comparison to how focused the conventional space is. Kind of like how we talk about there's always this middle ground that
And we are
we
forever
find,
standing there.
right? We're forever standing there because I do really think that sometimes the functional medicine doesn't give as much support as I think the stomach might need. And then I think the conventional system focuses on a lot on the stomach, but it's not necessarily helpful.
Well, they're doing the opposite of what most people need. And I will say this,
Right,
like,
exactly.
I feel like I have to kind of defend myself a little bit first before I say this. We're going to probably talk a lot of shit about PPIs again in this episode because for 98% of people who are taking them, they're just rubbish. But
Right.
they exist for a reason, and I'm not going to say that they need to be taken off the market, right? Because, like, I
Yeah.
think I might have shared this in the PPI as a SIBO root cause episode. My mom is a good example. She had what the ER doctors called a geyser of an ulcer that very quickly landed her in the ER, and she was literally bleeding out. And when the doctor suggested that she go on a PPI and sulcrophate and I forget what else, I was not the asshole who's like, no,
Yeah.
my mom's not going on Nexium, because like it was a big enough deal. So you use the
Right.
band-aids while you need them in special scenarios like that. Like, she was on the PPI for, I don't know, a month or two. The key is that the initial conversation was, oh, you just need to be on this forever, end of story. And after she had recovered to a point, we started talking about, yeah, you probably don't want to be on that forever. Let's have a strategy to wean you off of it. And then we slowly started to replace medication with natural things. And then we did more of the healing that way. But like, they do serve a purpose. It's just that most people, it's just they're overused. I've
Yeah.
had so many patients too who say basically, like, they go to the GI doctor with what later turns out to be like dysbiosis or SIBO or something. They get labeled with IBS and maybe they get prescribed like Linzess or something. And if that doesn't work, like the Hail Mary sometimes can be, oh, maybe you have silent reflux and they put you on a PPI. And I've had so many patients who say, I didn't have reflux. Like, I
Yeah.
had no perception of acid. I
Yep.
had no symptom of that. So it really confused me or upset me when the doctor said that. And I literally think that a lot of the times it's just a Hail Mary of like, let's see what
Is.
happens.
It
And it's
is.
very willy-nilly for a class of drugs that have so many potential side effects and can cause so many different nutrient deficiencies. But, you know, I think that, yes, the conventional space loves to talk about stomach acid because they
Right.
have drugs that effectively suppress the crap out of it. But there's no conversation as far as like the ecosystem of the stomach or the health of the stomach, at least not really, not from what I've seen.
Right. Exactly. There's a lot of focus on it, but not necessarily the right focus that I think would be helpful for the majority of 95% of the people that they're prescribing PPIs to. It's kind of a totally poor fit, almost damaging fit, unfortunately. Yeah, I think that like maybe we could talk a little bit about, like, from a GERD, gastritis, acid reflux standpoint, like, what are the key players to a healthy stomach, and what are the things that could potentially go wrong? If you want to kind of jump off from there.
Yeah, and I think the starting point, maybe one of the easiest starting points, is the microbial environment. So like we said, there's a bacteria that can inhabit the stomach called H. pylori, and it's not uncommon. When you do testing for it, you can test for it a couple of different ways. You could do a stool antigen test, you could do a breath test. It's not an uncommon thing to find. I will say, that being said, when I was running the GI map as my primary means of stool testing, which I no longer do, the GI map makes it look like a lot of people have H. pylori, but not very many of them are truly overgrown or particularly virulent. And it does stand in stark contrast. I've done quite a lot of breath testing for H. pylori, and I've done quite a lot of stool antigen testing for H. pylori through LabCorp, and I don't see it nearly as frequently as like the GI map seems to pick up on, and I don't know which one is better or worse for this. But even amongst the GI maps I've seen, a lot of times it'll pick up on some H. pylori, but none of the virulence factors are there, and it's not over like the quantity that the lab flags as problematic. I think if you have symptoms of reflux or GERD or gastritis, and you get a positive test for H. pylori, I think that it's worth addressing. If you don't have those symptoms and you have a positive test result for H. pylori, particularly something like a GI map test, I would probably lean towards not treating it. I have seen some research now where they're saying that H. pylori is an inhabitant of about 70% of people's stomachs. It's common enough that we think it's probably normal. And there's been some research to suggest that if you just go in guns a-blazin' and eradicate H. pylori for the heck of it, then some of those people go on to develop reflux, which is really interesting. So it might even have a protective role or a normal role that we're not really understanding fully. But it's certainly, if you have acid reflux and that's a symptom like that you know you have, and then you get testing back and it says that you have an overgrowth of H. pylori, then just treating that bacteria and getting that number shaved down a bit, doing some antimicrobials or some mastic gum, like that can be really profoundly helpful for people. And it's pretty simple. Take a couple of supplements, maybe a probiotic, and then you can knock that stinker back a couple of pegs, and then you're good to go. I don't know. Have you had a lot of like clear-cut H. pylori cases where it's just like, oh, here it is, mastic gum, you know?
Yeah, I definitely have it. It's interesting, like the conversation around H. pylori is so interesting because, again, we're in the middle, probably, because I feel like the conventional space is like there's no good H. pylori. I feel like if it shows up on a test, like they're like really into like doing really aggressive treatments for it, triple
Triple
antibiotic
therapy.
courses, all that jazz, which is a little bit extreme by our standpoints. And I also think there's kind of like I've definitely seen some microbiologists that are very like they don't necessarily love H. pylori being treated as frequently and kind of have an air of caution around it. Like what you were saying, there's definitely some protective, there seems to be some potential protective effects. I know there's a book called Missing Microbes. I don't know if you have ever read that book
I think I've heard of it.
it's by an MD. I think his name's Martin Blazer, Marty Blazer, something like that. But he talks a lot. He has like a whole chapter on H. pylori. That's really fascinating about how it might have protective effects on reflux. So it is like an inch, it's very interesting, and I do think there's kind of, I totally agree what you're saying. There's a line where it makes total sense to treat H. pylori. Sometimes I'll look at other markers too, on labs to see if it like how does your overall digestive function look? How's your immune system functioning? Like to see if it might be more problematic than not. And again, I think symptoms play a big role. Like you can't just look at these tests without the context of symptoms when they're not perfect. Like some of these stool tests, I think we want to be really conclusive and concrete, but I think we're still learning and kind of figuring things out. And sometimes even the reference ranges are not necessarily perfect either. So, like what we've talked about in the past. So, I'm in total agreement. I think that it does take looking at the context of your symptoms and what the lab's saying. I definitely go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say that's kind of the nice thing too. I will say I tend to take LabCorp and Quest results more at face value. Like
Right.
if there's an H. pylori breath test or a stool antigen test run by LabCorp or Quest or one of the mainstream labs, and it comes back positive, and the person has reflux, I'll pretty much always treat it. Again,
Yeah.
like not triple therapy like they do in the conventional
Yeah.
space, but like with some hippy dippy natural stuff, sure. And those are the cases where like I feel pretty comfortable treating it. What's convenient is that because like I typically try to bill as much through insurance as I can, I would never order those tests through LabCorp or Quest on a person who did not have reflux, right? Like,
Right,
so it's
right.
not as willy-nilly versus
Yeah.
the risk with something like the GI map or functional stool tests is that everything is just kind of glomped on. And I
Right.
see this too with the GI map with the C. diff toxin
Yeah.
genes, where like you're testing tons of people who have no symptoms of C. diff, and then they're getting some positives on the test, and it's making people freak the F out thinking they have
Right.
C. diff, and you have to rein those people back in and go, whoa, 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 hold on. You don't have any symptoms of C. diff, man. Like, you're good. You're good. It's
Yeah.
just a gene, and I have to explain that. But similarly, kind of the knee-jerk reflex, and this happens with some clinicians too, is that they'll take, something like the GI map at face value, and they'll go, oh, the GI map says your H. pylori is too high, so we need to kill it. And it's like, well, hold the phone there, bro. Like, does the person in front of you actually have reflux? Is it high and also virulent? Is it even out of the lab reference range, or was it just detected? So if it's a functional stool test or a functional test, like not LabCorp or Quest or something your primary care could order for you, take it with a grain of salt and only treat it if you have the symptoms that make sense. If you have acid reflux, and also like in my book, it needs to be particularly elevated or particularly virulent on the testing for me to take a functional lab seriously as far as H. pylori goes. But again, if like everything's lining up and you're like, oh, I do have acid reflux. Oh, it is high. Oh, it is virulent. Then by all means, go ahead and treat it. And sometimes the acid reflux story is just that simple.
Right,
You get that person
right.
on, some BioGaia probiotics and some mastic gum and some berberine, and they go frolicking off into the rainbows and everybody's happy.
Right.
More often, there's more to it than that. Have you heard? I forget where I heard this first, but I read some research that H. pylori and Candida can be buddy buddy. Are you familiar with
Yeah, I
this?
have heard that.
My
Yeah.
mind was blown. Like it was definitely one of those like mind blown emoji moments when I read those papers initially.
Yeah. Is it something? I thought it was something about biofilms.
Something.
I thought that they were, again, I'm trying to remember what I read. I thought it was about how, like, either H. pylori can hide in the biofilms of Candida or something like that. Is that what
Yeah,
you heard?
basically that's the gist I remember also. I don't remember
Yeah.
if it was the biofilms or if it was like within the physical structure of the yeast
Yeah.
itself, but basically the gist that we're trying to get at, acknowledging that neither of us read the papers again before
Right.
recording this episode, but that's what you get with podcasting.
Yeah.
The gist is that if you have H. pylori and it seems to be resistant to treatment, one of the things you might want to look into is whether or not you have Candida overgrowth, because Candida overgrowth local to the stomach can give H. pylori a nice little hideout and shelter it from your efforts to kill it. So for some people, I don't think this is the majority, but for some people, they need to treat the H. pylori and the Candida all at the same time in order to eradicate it or at least lower it. Again, I don't really know if we want to eradicate H. pylori, honestly.
Right,
But
right.
certainly you want to get it down below the threshold of like the lab reference range for whatever lab you're using.
Right.
And that, I don't think I've seen any cases of that yet, but just knowing that that could be a thing is useful to have in the back of your head.
Right, totally. I think again with H. pylori, the gist and kind of overarching theme that I think we're trying to make is that it's not necessarily a bad microbe all the time. Similar to how we've described microbial balance all along, it's like a lot of microbes are totally fine in normal amounts. And H. pylori is probably one of those microbes that could live in your stomach and not cause any trouble. But if it starts to overgrow, it can start to really affect stomach acid, and could be leading to those reflux type symptoms. So it can be like one of those things that just needs to be kept in check. If you're someone that has reflux, and so that's kind of the gist, I think. It's more of like a microbe that needs to be kept in check versus something that's good or bad.
Or like needs to be completely obliterated.
Right,
Like that's not
right.
necessarily the case. At least that's the direction that current research seems to be pointing, certainly.
Right. And I think the unfortunate thing we were kind of mentioning in the beginning is I think the conventional approach is like very much that this is a pathogen. Like through and through, and should be treated as such, when I don't think that the current evidence supports that it needs to be totally obliterated and you need to do triple or quadruple antibiotic therapy that could be kind of disastrous, downstream too.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, if you take, the triple antibiotic therapy or whatever they recommend and the PPI, because of course that's always part of it too, is like, yeah, throw a PPI in there, why not? You're going to affect the small intestine and the colon and motility, and like, you might successfully eradicate this quote unquote pathogen that you're trying to get rid of, but at what expense? And was your goal to eradicate the pathogen, quote unquote, even a good goal? Like, did you need to fully eradicate it, or could you just take it down a couple of pegs and then live in symbiosis with this thing? So yeah, I think H. pylori is an interesting one because I think it's starting to come full circle. I really hope that SIBO has the same kind of journey because I do think for a long time H. pylori was just like the pathogen that we have to kill, even in the functional medicine space, honestly. It's only in the last 5 or 10 years I've heard people other than myself say, hey, maybe we don't need to kill all of the H. pylori. That's really a more new thing. So I'm hoping that eventually SIBO comes to the same kind of full circle moment where we realize, oh, we don't need to completely sterilize the small bowel. Maybe there's more to SIBO than how we've been treating it for years.
I think that's a great point. I hope so too.
And we will be at the forefront of that shift, Amy. It'll be
Huzzah!
good times. But okay, so H. pylori as one potential cause.
I did want to mention one last thing about H. pylori, if I may.
You may.
Thank you. So I wanted to just throw this in there here because I think it's like important. And again, I don't necessarily, it just is frustrating to me that a lot of times what you were talking about, like if anyone's having any gut symptom, it might even be IBS. They're like, a lot of the conventional system is like throwing PPIs at things. Well, a PPI could create a perfect environment for H. pylori to take over the stomach because H. pylori does not want to be in a super acidic stomach. So having like a lower stomach acidity can make you more prone to an overgrowth of H. pylori. So I just think it really frustrates me from a conventional standpoint that you have probably people that could have H. pylori creating some of their symptoms being just put on PPIs as like a potential helper.
And then the H. pylori is like, woo.
I know the H. pylori is like, woo, like we got a gift. We love these PPIs, in your stomach. So I just think, again, it's another reason to be more careful of PPIs. Like you said earlier, there's definitely a time and place, but it's usually more rare than like the broad sweeping PPI recommendations that are currently popular in the conventional space. But I did just want to throw that in there about PPIs and H. pylori. It's kind of a
Well,
recipe for disaster, in my opinion.
and similarly, I'll piggyback off of that point and point out that a lot of people who believe they have low stomach acid could have H. pylori as a piece of that,
Right,
right? Like
100%.
maybe part of your low stomach acid deal is that H. pylori is present and that's suppressing your acid production add maybe a piece of this. Maybe you don't need 8-betaine HCl at every meal. Maybe you need to kill your H. pylori a bit or wrangle it back into place, and then you can get by with a more normal human amount of supplementation.
Right. I 100% think that that's a big part of the low stomach acid equation. I think it's funny because I feel like the low stomach acid like discussion tends to like not go any further than low, like it's just like, oh, you have low stomach acid. You take this HCl. Like there's not usually exploring what's driving the low stomach
Yeah.
acid, and it not like I typically think SIBO tends to be like something where I could see why someone might think it's a root cause without digging deeper, but like low stomach acid, like I don't know, to me I would think people would be wanting to dig a little bit deeper
Yeah.
on that one, but I find that a lot of times they don't. And I think low stomach acid could even be a huge player in things like gastritis, acid reflux in general, so I'm sure we'll kind of talk about that, but
Yeah,
yeah,
and
I wish there was more discussion around like the whys of the low stomach acid versus just throwing like, why does it make sense to throw 10 HCl caps at each meal versus exploring the underlying effect?
Yeah, and I think honestly, like, I could talk about low stomach acid a lot, so I think we should actually table that and have that as a completely separate episode.
Yeah, for sure.
We could do that. That'll be our next episode, perhaps. So we'll table that discussion. Just know for right now that low stomach acid is totally a thing, and there's more to it than just taking some pills and calling it a day. I think that's sufficient for the moment. But let's talk about the people, like let's say theoretically, the people who do have too much stomach acid or have more of that like burning, charring, gastritis, just really raw and irritated presentation to their symptoms. What sort of things might we think of as far as like the causes of that, and then how we want to address that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that typically from like a cause standpoint, I think I tend to think stress is at play in a lot of people that have gastritis. I think usually things like overt ulcers, typically there's an H. pylori component or something like driving the ulceration. At least in the research, I still think there's kind of the weird cases where there doesn't seem to be an H. pylori component,
Oh, we
but
should say too, NSAIDs, before we forget that.
oh
If
yes.
you're taking nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen, Advil, Aleve, Excedrin, that's actually what happened with my mom.
Yeah.
So when she got the geyser of an ulcer, the location happened to be right over a big artery, and that's why it turned into such a geyser. So it was just like luck of the draw that that's where it was, but it was because she was taking Excedrin migraine, not realizing it was an NSAID, and she's not supposed to have any NSAIDs because she had a gastric bypass. So like that was a huge no-no for her in particular. So
Yeah.
anyway, that's another one that can really char the heck out of your stomach.
Right. I think sometimes I'll look at things like just generally across the board, alcohol I would look at. Sometimes, again, like if people are drinking like kind of on a nightly or like, bi-nightly basis or something like that, and it might not seem like a lot, sometimes for them, if they have other stressors at play in the mix, it's just I might cut back on the alcohol. NSAIDs is a great one. Sometimes that one can be huge if people are doing Advil on a daily basis.
And it's over the counter, so a lot of people don't
Right,
even think about
right,
it. It's just
right.
like,
The part of their day.
yeah.
I think that, again, like I said, I think stress can be a key component. I sort of think of, I think again, usually I would say there's a typically going to be a conglomerate of different things happening in most of these cases where you're going to have a little bit more high stomach acid. Typically, I could be from coming off of a PPI as well. I know we've talked about that too, where there's like the cells of the stomach are actually changing when you're on a PPI and getting bigger, and when you try to go off a PPI, there's a flood of acid that
Yeah.
comes out from that. I also wonder about things like histamine
You are a mind
reactions.
reader. I was just thinking when I got the opportunity, I would bring up histamine.
Right,
Beautifully done.
histamine stuff. I mean, histamine is going to increase stomach acid. So if you're kind of have inflammation and there's more histamine being produced in the stomach, you can have higher stomach acid levels. That's why some of the like stomach reducing medications are essentially like
Antihistamines.
antihistamine.
Yeah.
So those would probably be the big ones that I'd probably look into initially. I don't know if you have any to add about higher stomach acid.
Yeah, I think the other one that I just have on my radar too is just like very broadly inflammation or
Right.
immune perturbation. So if it particularly if you have a person who's like got 8 gazillion autoimmune diseases or has a lot of joint pain and brain fog, like if you have a lot of other inflammatory symptoms, then it kind of stands to reason that the inflammation in the stomach could be part of like this whole body inflammation scenario. And then things like anti-inflammatories like turmeric or resveratrol, green tea, glutathione, like something to just quench that inflammation might be really, really useful.
Yeah.
I think also this is not something that I'm really skilled at, but I will make note that there's probably some particular like Chinese medicine diagnosis that would make sense too. Like, I don't know. I think I've heard, things like heart fire. I don't know if there's like stomach fire or like stomach heat or like damp heat. But there could be different presentations for what they would broadly call like heat in the body. And it could be that there's like a more particular like energetic TCM type of diagnosis to be made also. That's kind of the limit of my ability to explain it. I just know that I've heard TCM practitioners talk about like phlegm and heat and fire and like damp heat and dry heat. And I don't really have a concept of like how to explain that beyond what I just did.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think gastritis as a term just means stomach inflammation. That's all it means. So we know, and I kind of paint the picture too of like an internal sunburn. Like just how
Yeah.
like raw and irritated and just like your skin gets when you have a sunburn. Like think of that, but on the inside of your stomach. That's how I kind of picture gastritis. So then some of the same things that we might do to try to mitigate the inflammation on the skin or in another acute inflammatory scenario could be really helpful for gastritis. So aloe actually is a lovely one. And you could use that on your skin for a sunburn, or you could use that as a mucilaginous, like coating, soothing, cooling herb for the stomach. I really like marshmallow root quite a lot. And I would say you ideally want to get that not in a capsule, but if you could get like the loose, sifted bits of marshmallow root and then soak it in water for like a day or two and then drink that slimy, like liquid, when you prepare it that way as a cold infusion, it works the best. Slippery elm could be useful too, but I think I mentioned before I try not to rely on it quite as much because it is harder, like to sustainably harvest and use. So I try to lean more on marshmallow and aloe when I can. But slippery elm, if push comes to shove, could be really useful for this purpose too. And then one of my other favorites is licorice. A lot of people will get like the DGL. Deglycerized licorice chews or deglycerized licorice powder. And that could be useful. But I would just say that if you are a person who does not struggle with high blood pressure, you probably don't even need to get the DGL version. You could just get plain old licorice powder or plain
Yeah.
old licorice chunks and make like a tea out of it. And you could drink it with the glycyrrhiza in it. The only reason they make DGL as a product is because it can elevate blood pressure. And if you already have high blood pressure or like high normal, it could dip you into the realm of high blood pressure, which is problematic. But if you're like for me, I have low blood pressure, if anything. So I could
Yeah.
drink a gallon of licorice full blown with the glycyrrhiza in it, and it doesn't really matter much to me. If anything, it'll help my blood pressure. But the glycyrrhiza compound that they remove from DGL is anti-inflammatory and immune modulating. So when I'm able to, I try to use the whole licorice herb when I can, and then I'll either have it as like part of a tea, or have them make it as like a concentrate, or like put the powder in stuff. You can put the powder in smoothies, or just like make a little concentrate and drink it down. But all of those herbs that I just rattled off, the slippery elm, marshmallow, aloe, oops, sorry, and licorice, all have anti-inflammatory and coating and soothing actions on the stomach and can be really, really useful for gastritis and kind of quenching that inflammation.
Yeah, no, totally. I like all those herbs. I like that you kind of brought into, or you discussed the different forms of licorice. I typically am like lower blood pressure too, so having licorice as a whole herb, I've used it just to help with blood pressure
Yeah.
before in the past. So I
Yep.
do like that herb a lot. I was curious too. From a gastritis, I just wanted to like touch on this and maybe like stomach issue situation. I think that there is a component too that might be gastroparesis related or emptying issues. I don't think it's discussed a lot, but I feel like, again, if you're eating a meal and things aren't necessarily moving optimally, you feel like things are kind of sitting there. And that's a problem with SIBO in general, if there's like a brain gut access issue or, you're not moving things along optimally. I think that can be at play with things like GERD, gastritis, and acid reflux too, if they're not kind of moving properly. So I definitely think things like ginger can sometimes help too. Sometimes they can cause burn as well, so forms might matter there. But I think that, again, if there's like a motility issue at play, you might want to explore like gastroparesis being at play in the whole acid reflux, GERD, gastritis scenario.
And that again will really dovetail beautifully into the stress conversation.
Yeah,
And you know, we
for
have the two
sure.
episodes. We have an episode on the gut-brain axis and an episode about the vagus nerve. And really, in those episodes, we talked a lot about how stress and what could be called adrenal fatigue, like how that all kind of layers in and just screws up your motility and screws up your stomach emptying. And I do see oftentimes, and I'm not one to talk, like I've historically denied how stressed I am, or I've denied you know, things like anger or resentment or like it, basically any icky feeling I historically have denied or shut out or shut down, or like, you know, I like pretend it's not there. And I think that's a lot more common than we talk about in society, but you've got to deal with your stress in whatever way you can. Whether that means, you know, herbal adaptogens, therapy. I mean, God, there's like so many resources. I just signed up because we're recording this after the new year. Have you ever followed or seen the Holistic Psychologist on Instagram or YouTube? So I have a lady crush on her, first of all. She's my favorite follow on Instagram, probably just because I've learned a lot, but in really small chunks. And like, I'll scroll and I'll see things and I'm like, oh, that's why I think that way. Or, oh, that's why I feel that stressed about that thing. And one of my things for 2021, I signed up for her Self Healers Circle,
Oh,
just
nice.
like kind of unpacking some of that stuff. Like, you know, stress is a whole big tangled mess. And I know a lot of people, myself included, have historically kind of denied it and said, like, no, it's not stress, whatever. I just need some fancy pill, or I just need another round of antimicrobials. But, like, trust me, guys, just work on your stress in whatever way you can. And that will probably have a lot of overlapping benefit, particularly if you have problems with motility or gastroparesis or like reflux, GERD, like all the stuff that we're talking about. Honest to God, stress plays a big role on that.
I almost think like when in doubt, look at stress. Like even if you don't, it's not necessarily super clear. And it's really subtle. I think stress is just, It's so pervasive, like you're talking about. And I know we are both more people pleasers, which probably means we're holding stuff in and not necessarily dealing with some of the emotions we have, which then kind of we internalize things, which is not conducive for stress relief. So I totally agree with you. I mean, stress is going to disrupt every aspect of digestion. And it's something that we don't necessarily value rest and stress management and
Not at
therapy as
all.
a culture. It tends to be like seen as, I don't know, we just don't value it. So we're not really usually investing a lot of time and energy on it, but it can just be so crucial. So I do think, like, when in doubt, if you've kind of are in a rut from a gut standpoint and you've had stomach issues for a while, whether you've had SIBO and IBS in conjunction with it, or if it's mainly just stomach stuff, looking at stress really deeply and figuring out, like, what can I do today to manage stress? I think sometimes if you kind of just focused on your daily routine, like, what can I do within my day to help me help build tolerance to stress, help me manage my stress, and think of it in that way versus like I need to meditate every day for an hour. Like, small doses of some sort of habit building, I think, can be really helpful from a stress standpoint.
Yeah, and I think even I think just allowing yourself to spend the time and money and effort on yourself, like that's a piece for me. Like just telling myself it's okay for me to spend money on myself, or it's okay for me to spend time to go to acupuncture or, do whatever. Like just kind of give yourself permission first, and yeah, just like realize it doesn't make you a bad person. It doesn't make you less than. It doesn't make you like weak. It's just, I mean, honestly, if you're alive in this day and age, you have stress. If you're breathing right now, you have stress. But it's just a matter of like how deeply that's affecting you and what tools are going to resonate more with you. There's a gazillion ways that you could try to mitigate stress. Like mine for 2020, I got more into art, and I forgot that art was like a huge part of my life, and I loved creating beautiful things and like drawing and painting and coloring, and I fell out of touch with that part of myself until the pandemic made it much more obvious and unignorable that I had stress. And then that's one thing I'm grateful for, is that the shitstorm of a year that was 2020 brought me back to art, and now like I've been creating beautiful things, and that's been really nice for stress relief and just kind of like tuning the world out and just being alone with my thoughts for a little bit. But if you're not artsy, that might not call to you. Maybe you want to, go for a run or meditate or whatever. Like, you do you is the point of that.
Oh, that's so lovely. I love that you're into art again. It's interesting. I was listening to Anna Faris's podcast, The Actress. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she has like a segment at the end of her show where they like help people with dating problems. But she's been having like psychologists on with them and to discuss like the problem that they're having, and they kind of talk it through. But one of the psychologists said something that was really interesting, and I think it's like it when you were talking about you were kind of disconnected with art, it reminded me of it. She was basically saying, like, try to remember who you were as like a, an 8-year-old kid or a 10-year-old kid, and like what were you like? Like, what excited you? Like, were you curious? Were you rambunctious? Like, did you like just going to your room and reading like everything you could get your hands on? Like, what were you like? And basically, as you get older, a lot of times you get disconnected with like almost like that younger, like very kind of true self. And she was kind of advising the person to think about like what you were like and how you can re re-engage with some of those traits that are really core to who you were like as a kid that kind of just tend to sometimes fade a little bit.
Or
And I
like the
thought that.
layers of adulthood kind of cover it up.
So it was a really interesting discussion, and I hadn't really heard it discussed like that. But I think even like what you're describing as reconnecting with art, I think reconnecting with like aspects of yourself that, you haven't in a while can be so huge for finding pleasure and joy in your life, which is all important for stress management. But yeah, I love that thought of like really kind of sitting on like what was I like as a 10-year-old and like how can I manifest that now as an adult?
Well, now I'm curious, dear Amy, what were you like as a 10-year-old, and what
Oh,
were your
Lord.
hobbies and interests?
Oh, man. As a 10-year-old, I was always outside. So I think for me, definitely making time to be outside. I was very playful. And I again, like, I think as we get older, playfulness isn't necessarily as valued as much, but playfulness is really key, I think, for me. And I've definitely noticed since getting like our puppy that there's been like an added layer of playfulness that's there. My parents were like, my dad was a great dad because he would literally play with us from like the time he got home from work to like the time he went to bed. Like we went to bed. So their play was just a really big part, I think, of my childhood. So I was always playing, always like making things. I'd always make like random stuff in our garage. So like creativity definitely was a big part of who I was as a 10-year-old. So I think it's just like finding little ways to make sure you're connecting with like a kind of true self that's in there as a from a your childhood self. I think is key. So I think for me, it's definitely being outside playing. Like I love playing with my nieces. Like that's always super fun for me, and really finding ways to be creative, I think is key. Sometimes business-wise, like I'll get caught up with the one-on-one work, and then I don't have as much time to do things like podcasting or writing blogs, doing those sorts of things. And I do feel that, like if I go too long doing like really hardcore one-on-one stuff and haven't done like program creation or things like that, that tends to really excite me doing creative projects. So I feel it if I'm like out of balance. So I definitely try to do more creative projects when I can. What
Good
were
to.
you like as a 10-year-old, Nikki?
Oh gosh. I was quieter.
Yeah.
I've become a lot more extroverted and outgoing, starting particularly like college onward.
Yeah.
But high school and back, I was pretty introverted, pretty quiet, except like with most people, I was like that. But then with my few closest friends or family, then I was like really goofy and weird, you know,
Yeah.
and like really, I don't know, like engaged. I think it was just like I was not engaged with the rest of the world in the same way, because I kind of was like over their bullshit at an early age.
Yeah.
So there was that element. And I also, similar to now, I deeply worried about what other people thought of me.
Yeah.
So there was that element of like, I've got to protect, I've got to like
Yeah.
shelter. But I was definitely more introverted, and if I was left to my own devices, and I'm an only child, so this makes some sense, I was either outside playing with the animals, because I grew up on a small farm. So at any given time, we had like two or three horses, one or two dogs, about a million cats, and at various points, we had chickens. So I was out like playing with the barn cats, or out in the horse pastures, like exploring with the dogs and the horses following me. So animals is a biggie for me. Another one, definitely outdoors. And whether it was out in the horse pastures exploring, or like we had a little creek down back, so I would like take the dogs down to the little creek and like try to make a bridge or something,
Yeah.
or look to see if there was any frogs or whatever. Or we'd go visit my grandparents in Connecticut, and they lived out in the boondocks, and I would go like hiking in the woods with my cousins and get into trouble. And so yeah, outdoors and animals abound, and also art. Like if I was left to
Yeah.
myself, I would be drawing or doodling, or coloring or doing some sort of like arts and crafts project. In high school, I sewed a pair of like pleated samurai pants. I don't know if I ever told you that. I was really into this
Nice.
anime called Samurai X, Rurouni Kenshin, and he had these hakama, these like pleated pants, and I hand sewed these a pair of these pants. No template, no nothing. I just did it all by hand. And I was so proud of it that when I finished like the costume and I made kind of a makeshift kimono to go underneath it, I just wore it to high school one day. Not on
Yeah.
Halloween.
Nice.
Not on Spirit Day. No, nothing. It was just like a random day in the middle of 11th grade. I just wore like this like samurai costume, and I used like a Christmas paper tube, like a wrapping
Yeah.
paper tube, and I put that in my hilt like it was my sword.
Oh my
And I just like
gosh.
busted out that the cardboard tube sword, and I was like a samurai for the day.
Oh, amazing.
So, but like I can't tell you how many months I spent sewing those pants and sewing like the makeshift kimono and like getting the costume all ready. So yeah, either creating something like with fabric and sewing or with paper and like crafting was a big part of life for me. And yeah, I like
Awesome.
forgot about that until
Yeah.
this year. So I'm glad for that at least. But yeah, so to bring it home, because we probably got a little off topic, but hopefully it was valuable. So for acid reflux and like GERD, gastritis kind of stuff, some of the tenets that you could think of, I'm going to attempt to recap here, are H. pylori slash dysbiosis. That could involve candida. It could involve other bacteria. Maybe we don't know yet.
Right.
But some local dysbiosis to the stomach can be a thing for people. I would just suggest that if you're using functional tests like a GI map, take it with a little bit of a grain of salt and resist the temptation to obliterate H. pylori anytime you see it ever. For some people, low stomach acid is a thing. We're going to talk about that in our next episode because that's kind of a doozy. For some people, maybe there is some acid beyond what you're capable of tolerating, and that's creating some inflammation or some actual acid reflux. A lot more of that game is going to come from coating and soothing the stomach and getting that mucus layer really up to snuff so it's actually doing its job and protecting you from that acid. That's actually, I'm glad that I'm recapping because I'm going to go back to that for a moment.
Yeah.
Is on any given day, the goal is that you will have a lot of really acidic, nasty stomach acid and you will be blissfully unaware of it.
Yeah.
Right? So, like right now, I would hope that my stomach pH is like 2 or 3.
Yeah.
And that's really caustic, like battery acid. But I'm unaware. Ideally, that's what should happen. And the reason for that is because, yes, you have a lot of acid and it's very caustic, but you also have a mucus lining separating the cells that make up your stomach from the vat of acid that's contained within.
Right.
So, working on that mucus lining can be really important too. And I think that's what a lot of those herbs help, like the
Yeah.
licorice, the marshmallow, slippery elm, aloe. Like a lot of that, I think, helps build up and strengthen that mucus layer. I have a YouTube video series about that, about things that will either impede the health of the mucus lining or will help strengthen it, or like things that you could do to help strengthen it. So you could check that out another time. But basically, a lot of it goes back to making sure you're nutritionally replete. You need things like protein, you need sulfur, you need some oligosaccharides to make mucus. Certainly, you want your mucus making cells to get the proper signaling and do their job appropriately. And a lot of that goes back to the microbiome and making sure you have a healthy microbiota and that you don't have some blatant case of dysbiosis. But really, you want that separation between you and your acid so that you can waltz around day to day and not be aware of, again, the charring potential of your stomach acid. And you can just waltz around like nobody's business with a whole lot of acid in your stomach.
Yeah.
Do you have anything to add to the mucus
I
conversation?
think again, you're right on. I think you want a thick mucus layer across the board down the whole gut lining, but especially in the stomach when you're having all that stomach acid and it's really needed to protect your gut lining and your stomach lining. And I think the good news is that the stomach lining can turn over relatively quickly as well. So if there is gastritis and those sorts of things, like you can do these things that should help in a relatively, again, I never want to say like quick, speedy period of time, but I would think some of those herbs and things that you'd get relief relatively quickly by doing them or you should, unless there is maybe a bigger issue like an H. pylori or something like that, if you wanted to try approaching the stomach and building up mucus lining support, trying some of those herbs could be a good symptom reliever relatively quicker than some other strategies. Is that what you see typically?
Yeah, I think that I would say, and this I thought of this question also is at what point would you consider like going to a GI and getting a scope? Or like at what point do you think, hey, this might be more serious? If it is, if it's run of the mill, like a little bit of irritation, a little bit of gastritis, I would think that you would see some forward progress within the span of a couple of weeks of doing some of these natural therapies. For me, to answer my own question, silly enough as it is, if you are at a point where like you've tried a lot of the things that we've talked about, so you've tried, you know, evaluating for H. pylori and treating it if need be, you've done the marshmallow, the slippery elm, the licorice, the aloe, you've avoided some of the higher histamine foods and played with that. And if you're still experiencing a significant amount of reflux, that's the point where I would consider getting a scope and seeing, okay, do you have an actual ulcer? And can they like take a little sample from around the ulcer to see if that local area has some H. pylori? Because maybe it's not overgrown throughout the whole stomach. Maybe you just have a small pocket near the ulcer that's, and then you need to treat H. pylori as it turns out. Or, you know, maybe that's where you say, thank you very much. I'm going to use your Band-Aids. And maybe you do, I just said do. Maybe you do a week or two of a PPI low dose. Or maybe you do a few weeks of something like sulcrophate that's going to be a little bit more oomph to really soothe and coat and protect the stomach while you're kind of juggling the other things. I do think that those tools have a time and a place. Try the natural stuff first, by all means. But if you're still struggling with really severe symptoms and a lot of burning in particular, that might be a time where you would want to get an endoscopy and have somebody take a look at the stomach itself and just make sure that there's no like big honking tumor or ulcer or something, you know, more insidious that needs to be dealt with.
I agree with that. I think that typically, probably by the time most people find us, they've had the gamut of the endoscopy colonoscopy. But that's such a great point to know when to actually do the endoscopy, because there's been a few people that I've worked with where I've definitely been like, it might be worthwhile to get kind of scoped. And sometimes it's easier just if depending on symptoms I've kind of and what their doctor's thinking, but some people do the full gamut where they'll get the endoscopy and colonoscopy because they're having lower GI issues too. So depending on the case, sometimes you can kill two birds with one stone if you're having lower GI symptoms. But that's such a great point to not necessarily, like, if things aren't going well, to not just keep doing the natural therapies, at least explore and make sure that you're not missing a bigger thing that's going to need more medical care, like what you're saying, the where PPIs actually are helpful, or like some medications that lower stomach acid and can kind of soothe and heal for a period of time would be helpful.
I think my stance has been, and I tell this to patients pretty frequently, is that Band-Aids aren't intrinsically bad. You just want to acknowledge that they're Band-Aids. And even, you know, even something like I said, like the PPIs, okay, do you want to be on them forever? Hell to the no. Is it maybe useful for a couple of weeks while you're juggling some other stuff to give yourself the opportunity to heal? Yeah, possibly. You know, I wouldn't say that you should go waltz out to your nearest Walgreens, pick up some over-the-counter Nexium and just start taking it for the hell of it. But if you're really struggling with a lot of acid reflux and it really impeding your ability to live your life, like get scoped. I mean, maybe entertain the thought of doing some drugs, but just know that medical provider 99.999% of the time is going to tell you to go on the PPI, and then there will be zero conversation about how to get off. So that
Right.
other part needs to be on you, and maybe a holistic professional or somebody who's going to give a rat's ass about this, where it's like, okay, you do the sulcrophate, you do the Nexium, you do whatever for like a couple weeks or a month, and now we can start replacing it with DGL or marshmallow or whatever, and like you
Yeah.
start to pull back gradually. But don't be the crunchy person who cuts their nose off to spite their face and refuses all medical care just because it's not natural.
Yeah.
There are times where you could just be thankful that the medicine exists,
Yeah.
and again, like you just don't want to be the person who doesn't question and ends up taking Nexium for 20 years.
Yeah.
So use it as a band-aid with the intention of taking off the band-aid, and then you'll be okay.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look at that. All right. So wrapping up. Yeah, I think we hit a lot of the high notes. Like I said, aside from the stomach acid piece of it, the low stomach acid, which will be in the next episode. And we could probably, well, I don't know. Do you want to lump the next topic in with that too, or should we continue for another moment? What about lower esophageal sphincter tone?
Oh yeah, this is a good one.
Oh, let's do it now. I can't resist.
Okay. Oh, good
The
Lord.
listeners will be so confused. They're like, I thought she was going to
I
end the episode like three times already.
know.
I can't resist
But
the
wait.
temptation to keep talking. But wait, there's more. If you sign up now for $19.95, two. Okay, now I have to interject with this. So, one of my favorite comedians, I don't know if you are into stand-up comedy much at all, but Mitch Hedberg had a bit where he was like, oh, God, how does it start off? He said, just once, I want it to be, you can get this thing for two easy payments and one complicated payment. We're not going to tell you which one it is, but the mailman will be shot to death, the envelope will not seal, and you must pay in wampum. Good luck, motherfuckers. Just like,
Oh
anyway,
my
I was
gosh.
trying to embody more of like the late night infomercial, but wait, there's more, and then it just made me launch into a Mitch Hedberg quote. I forget how the joke actually started off, but you get the gist. So anyway, so but wait, there's more. So for those of you who are not anatomy nerds, the lower esophageal sphincter is a sphincter of muscle that lives at the very, very, very bottom of the esophagus slash very, very, very top of the stomach, and it's the gatekeeper between the esophagus and the stomach. And one of the things that is pretty well supported with reflux is that the tone or the tightness of that sphincter can be, what is the medical term? Loosey-goosey, or compromised or low in tone. So then what happens is if you don't have that nice tight sphincter sealing off the stomach, then some of that acid gets a chance to reflux or come back up into the esophagus. And now we're talking more about esophagitis rather than gastritis. So we have inflammation and irritation, that internal sunburn of the esophagus rather than the stomach. And that can be a thing for a lot of people who are suffering from GERD. Do you have any additional pearls to add to that conversation?
No, I mean, I think that there's definitely some dietary things that tend to help if there's problems with that tone and that sphincter. I think sometimes eliminating things like tomatoes, which are again are high in histamine too, so like there could be some overlap there. Things like chocolate, also high in histamine, but have been shown to affect the tone. Caffeine sometimes can affect the tone, so sometimes eliminating caffeinated beverages. I think in general, things like vagal tone are gonna affect that sphincter as well and how that's operating.
Before you get too far on that rabbit trail, though, I'll add one more to the list of things that muck
Okay.
with the tone. Peppermint.
Oh yeah, peppermint for sure. Such
Biggie.
a
And
great
that's big
add.
with the IBS world because everybody and
Yep.
their brother are taking the peppermint, enteric coated peppermint capsules.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a great one.
Or gum.
And a lot of the teas too, like, if you buy like a digestive tea, it always has like
Peppermint.
peppermint in it of
Yep.
some sort. No, that's a great one. And I think a lot of times, like, I don't think that typically you have to avoid those foods forever, but doing some work again on the stomach and helping to raise the tone in different ways
Yeah,
could be
well, and
helpful there.
you
Go
already
ahead.
hit the nail on the head, vagal tone, because
Right,
that little band of muscle is just told what to do by the vagus nerve. And again, that dovetails back into OMFG, work on your stress in whatever way calls to you. Get back in touch with that 10-year-old you who loved frolicking in the pasture with the horses or, doing whatever. But like that kind of stuff cannot be understated, underemphasized. Because it really lower esophageal sphincter tone problems really boil down to a gut brain axis slash vagus nerve issue more
Yeah,
than anything else.
for sure. Yeah, like these eliminations can be helpful to not kind of add any stress to the situation, but getting the vagus nerve under control is probably the biggest factor. And I also don't want to glaze over the fact that you said animals were part of your 10-year-old self. Are you gonna get another animal anytime soon? Maybe 2021, a puppy or a kitten or something?
2021, totally getting a dog, if not two.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Now, my husband does not know this yet, but
Oh,
so
yes.
what happened? No, I
He's
can
your
get him on board
dog.
for this because, so the for those of you who don't know, so Amy has the cutest puppy ever, and I get photos and videos of Chip on the regular, which bring me great joy. We haven't had a dog for about 2 years. We lost our beagle right around the new year, actually, to liver failure. And we have been beagleless ever since, which is very upsetting to me. My husband these days has been more in the mode of like, oh, it's an additional chore, it's a thing to do. So his cop out, ready for this? His cop out has been, we can get a dog when Jess goes to kindergarten. Well, buddy, old pal, 2021 is when that kiddo's going to kindergarten, so you're getting me a dog. So in his mind, at least, he's been building up for like 2 years that, okay, he'll have more time and wherewithal to deal with the dog. And he likes dogs. Like, it's not that he doesn't like dogs, but he has it in his mind that he will have the time for a dog when our 5-year-old goes to kindergarten. So 2021 is the
Oh my
year I've been
gosh, I
waiting for.
cannot wait.
It's just
I
a matter of
cannot.
when, but I advocate for two because we had one beagle for a while and that was great. But then we had two and it was nice because like they could keep each other company and be BFFs forever. And I liked having the bonded pair. So I'm going to advocate for two, but we tend to adopt elders.
I'm trying to advocate for two as well, but it's not going well.
Keep
Not
at it.
going well. I'll have to keep you guys posted. I found some
Yes.
really cute ones. One was named Tulip and one was named Charlie, but they got nicked, so I'll have to find some new dogs to try to
Okay. You'll
work
know.
on.
You'll like a piece of your soul will know when you see that little face.
My
And that's why I
gosh.
have to be careful looking at the Carolina Beagle Rescue Facebook page
Oh
because
my
all the faces I'm
gosh.
like, that's the one. But
You're gonna
yes.
match to one that you're not gonna be able to get. It's the worst.
That's okay. I will find whoever it is out there. But yes, that's on the radar. I would
Okay,
also,
great.
full disclosure, I would be a crazy cat lady. I would have like 30 cats if I could, but I married somebody who's allergic to them.
No.
I know. It's a good thing for Mikey, he has other redeeming qualities. But yes, I for sure would do that. For right now, I can scratch the itch by visiting my parents who have two dogs and two cats. So I can at least have animal time when I go to visit my parents.
Aw.
Yeah.
Well, when we meet in person, I'll bring Chip.
Yes. Done. Sold. All right,
Aw.
guys. So now I think for real, we have covered most of the things that we wanted to cover. So to reiterate, OMG, work on stress in whatever way you can, whatever way calls to you. It's way easier said than done, but just know there are so many tools available to you. But it really cannot be overstated how important stress is, particularly when it comes to SIBO and also the GERD, gastritis, acid reflux kind of stuff. I would say, making sure that your microbial environment is in check, particularly if you have more of the supposed high stomach acid symptoms like the burning and the gastritis. I think watching out for H. pylori is important, making sure you're nutrient replete and you're not restricting your diet too much so that you can make things like mucus and keep the lining of the stomach happy and healthy, and then possibly avoiding triggers of things that will elevate acid or lower the tone of the lower esophageal sphincter, like the high histamine foods, or peppermint. That can be important too. And then coating and soothing as need be with things like herbs or maybe just maybe medications like sulcrophate and maybe a PPI, although I don't really recommend it if you can get away with not doing it. But there's a lot of options available to you. It's just a matter of juggling like what your root causes are, what makes the most sense, and like what you have tried and what you haven't tried, and going from there. But that's my executive summary. Amy, do you have anything else to add?
That was brilliant. You're
Nice.
brilliant. I
All
don't have
right.
anything else to add.
Boom. That is a wrap then. So
Excellent.
as always, you guys, if you're listening on podcasting app, if you could please, please rate us 5 stars because we know you love us. Come on now. If you could rate us 5 stars on your podcasting app of choice, that would be marvelous and it would help us grow this podcast and reach more people. If you are on YouTube, my platform of choice, if you could go ahead and comment down below with any questions, like the video, ring the bell, subscribe to the channel, do whatever you do on the YouTubes. But all of that helps the algorithm favor us and ultimately reach more people so that we can keep podcasting for you all. And what is it's our Instagram is ibs.freedom.podcast and our Gmail is ibsfreedompod@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you in said comments and emails and Instagrams. Until next time, Amy, I love and appreciate you. We will talk
Love and
again soon.
appreciate you. Can't wait.